Welcome to Why Knowledge Matters. Welcome, Joe. Great to have you.
Thank you for this invitation. It's great to be here.
What made you interested in identity and learning?
The question that brought me to explore identity and learning was, what do people need to live a good life as an individual, educator, policymaker, and parent for that matter? This is a fundamental question, and it too often goes unasked or not deeply explored because it is often assumed and taken for granted. Answering this question provides a guide for directing one's energy, attention, and work. When focused, energy and attention, they are much more effective. And as a spoiler, in trying to answer this question, I found learning and identity to be fundamental facets of what people need to live a good life. However, this question, what do people need to live a good life, is a deceptively complex question that does not have a single or definitive answer. And yet, working through trying to answer this question offers insights into guiding not only others' education, but our own life as well. Here's an example of the complexity of answering, what do people need to live a good life? Some might focus on the word need in this question and say, well, that's simple. We can use ideas like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, such as basic physiological and safety needs, psychological needs like belongingness, love, and esteem, and self-fulfillment needs. However, there are three interrelated problems with this paradigm as it relates to the question, outside of the established criticisms in scientific literature about the hierarchy itself and its universal nature. The first problem with thinking that Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a way to answer this question is that we are not only talking about the concept of needs, but also the concept of good. Maslow created the hierarchy based on human motivation, not based on an idea of good, because good is not a concept that is scientific. Good is axiological or about value. Though many may conflate motivation and good, they are not the same. One may be motivated to dominate over someone or a group to meet a need for safety or perceived safety, or motivated by greed to harm the earth for personal gain and at the expense of others to meet a need for esteem. These two motivations work just fine within Maslow's hierarchy as meeting needs, but they're not good. So we have to go beyond just needs and motivations. Maslow's hierarchy is meant to be descriptive, how things are. The question we are talking about is fundamentally analytic, and eventually the answers will be contextually normative or about how things ought to be. So I'm not criticizing the hierarchy as a theory. I'm saying that we're asking something else. The second issue is that Maslow's principles themselves do not offer concrete, contextually grounded knowledge about how to enact these needs in life. Nor should it, for that matter, because context will determine how these needs are enacted. In my work to answer these central questions, I have come to understand the diversity and variety of how these needs are enacted in the lives of different people, and even in different contexts in the life of one person. This is true for all levels of these needs. So let's use an example of a person's needs for security and safety to highlight this point. The need for security and safety will be enacted differently in a community where there's very little crime due to high degrees of trust, such as in many Scandinavian countries or in many small rural communities. Here, houses are rarely locked and children are allowed to go out on their own. So the need is met by the community relations. In communities where there's low crime due to surveillance and the mistrust of others, such as some gated communities in the United States or highly policed cities, the need is met by having cameras and security detail of some kind with training and certification be present to roam around to make sure that security and safety are met by force. Here, people will feel secure because of an external system. They may not lock their doors because there's a clear delineation between who is allowed in and who is not, as well as an external force to ensure that violence or theft does not happen or is rectified if it does. In a place where there is a high degree of crime due to inequity, poverty, and low opportunities for a portion of the community, such as in large cities around the world, then the need for security is created by locks on doors, bars on windows, and security systems. Of course, not everyone's needs are met in this scenario. We are just speaking about one individual, which is an issue that we'll talk about later. That individual will likely be able to feel secure in these different environments through these different adaptations. So we can see how different these principles may play out. Which means that we cannot answer the question, what do people need to live a good life universally or concretely, because they will need different things depending on where they live and the context they live in. And as an aside, it's important to note that Maslow's hierarchy assumes, which is what I was talking about earlier, an individualistic and personal perspective. It is about one person's needs in order to live their life that they're motivated to live. This is not necessarily a problem, though it may be, but it does need to be recognized to understand the range and limits of the theory. Because when in my question, we're asking about people, not just one person, although that one person is part of this group of people, it is really important to think about what it means to be an individual, and then also what it means to live in community. And those things need to be considered together. The third issue within this paradigm is an assumption that we are making, that we are talking primarily about what can be provided to people, not about what people can do and decide themselves, with the exception of the self-actualization point of the pyramid, which is about self-actualization, obviously. This is crucial as it is the source of many of our problems and key to learning as well as identity. The question, what do people need to live a good life, is not only about what I as an educator or the state can give to others, but what others can learn to create on their own to lead good lives. Because agency is fundamental to learning and identity and living a good life. This does not mean that people don't need to live in certain environments to be able to live well. We all need certain material goods to be able to do this, but it's about both and not either or. So this is why I focus my attention on learning. I don't focus primarily on the cognitive mechanisms of learning, though I study this as well, but the human axiological and attentional agential aspects of learning. In other words, addressing the values and learning those values and how to enact those values, that kind of learning as a fundamental part of this idea of need and good. So addressing sub questions like, why do some of us learn how to play video games quickly, but learn how to properly mow the lawn slowly? What are the things we need to learn to become agents in building our own good life? What do we learn as being good? How do we learn what good is? And how does that affect other things that may be good? What other people may think about what good is? And how do we live together with those different conceptions of good, or with similar conceptualizations of good? How do power and good interact? And others are just a few of the questions that come from these considerations. So all that is just addressing the first part of this key question. What do people need to live a good life? The question itself also uses the term good. So we were talking about need and we focused on need, but good is a whole nother component of this question, a crucial component that needs to be defined in ways that are not being considered yet. So we need to figure that out too. So what is good? So in life, that'll depend. Some cool water when you're hot and thirsty is good. But if you're cold and hungry, cool water is probably not that good. Of course, there are some more general goods like feeling loved and feeling able to love. The ability to sustain one's life through their own capacity to get food, have shelter, and those other Maslow needs can be good. But those are general and not concrete. We do not have a good in the world that is the concept of security. We feel secure through a variety of concrete physical and emotional phenomena. So if someone were to say, here's security, and give you a card with the word security on it, you'd look at them funny. That's not what security is. So what does good really mean in life and in our living world? Furthermore, there are a large number of people who have physical security and their needs met, but do not feel that life is good for them. Also, we should mention that there are some few lucky and very strongly willed agential people who may not have all of their physically based needs met to the degree that others would think they need to be in order to live a good life, but they still feel like they're living a good life. So even though these people are rare, they do exist. I've met people like this and they're very inspirational. So what is good? That is the deep question when it comes to education. One of the things that I noticed through my research, interacting with and interviewing people from many walks of life and in many different positions in society, is that good will greatly depend upon your identity. Identity is understood pragmatically through the lens of everybody containing multiple identities, and each of those identities having different components or aspects, such as role identity, group identity, cultural identity, and personal identity. So in the context of a role identity, a farmer will see good differently from an engineer, who will see it differently from a doctor, who will see it differently from a social scientist. Even in relationships, which is part of our group identity, One of the things that you find with your significant other is that what good means to you, for example, the kind of place you want to live or the kinds of movies that you want to see, may not mean the same to your partner. This is true because of personal identities and preferences, but also points to deeper facts and facets about expectations and what different choices mean to each of us. So in the quest for understanding good, I learned that identity is a core component of what makes something good. We live in a relationship with our environment and our preferences and our internal drive. So what I see as good because of my identity as someone who likes soccer may be seen as something that's not good for somebody else who doesn't like soccer, for example. So this is why I study identity, because it allows us to understand the definition of good and the way in which good is enacted in the world, because our identities help us learn what good is and make good part of our lives and how we orient ourselves. So to recap, in attempting to answer the question, what do people need to live a good life? And reflecting upon that question, I continue to uncover deeper questions that are components of this overarching question that I felt were particularly suited to study in order to elucidate what it means to have a need and what it means to live a good life. Learning and identity are both fundamental to addressing this question and to living a good life.
What made you interested in identity and learning?
The reason that what do people need to live a good life became the central overarching question for my research was due to observations about our current time and circumstances in the United States and in North America generally. And then eventually from my experiences traveling to a number of countries outside of North America. Being in my teens at the turn of the century and at the turn of the millennium, I noticed a gradual but profound paradigm shift, largely due to communication technologies taking off and the greater ease and ability to travel, allowing for more interaction with different cultures, ways of life, and choices, and a great sense of agency in choosing one's life path, a greater sense of agency in choosing one's life path than before, as well as a greater sense of vulnerability, tension, crisis, and fear as compared to the decades after World War II. In the past, and this is a very broad generalization that does not cover other people's experiences, but covers the narratives that I picked up as a youth and then throughout my early 20s. So I'm not making any truth claims here. I'm just talking about what motivated me and the observations that I picked to make sense of the world and then what I wanted to do in the world. So just, you know, this is just speaking about my experience, not everybody else's experiences. So I'm sharing the impressions I had, which spurred the question that I have now dedicated a lot of my professional life to answering. I've found that in the past, stations in life were more limited than they are today. You had to take care of a number of responsibilities, and you had a few limited options in profession, depending upon who your parents were and or your own capacities and initiative and how you interacted and maneuvered throughout the various pushes and pulls of life within different social organizations. People in the working classes were also further removed from the dominant classes, so aspirations were limited. For example, in the 1950s, the main narrative and primary aspiration of the emerging adults, people in their late teens to early 30s who were establishing themselves, was to find a well-paying job, buy a house, raise a family, enjoy the basically sensual pleasures of new technologies, purchasing novel technology, eating good food, and for spiritual questions, go to church. In the 1960s and 70s, the main narrative was to question the narrative of the decade before, or the decades before, through thinking about new forms of government and new kinds of primarily sensual experiences, as well as new religions. Though knowledge of alternative religions was pretty limited, because even though globalization and global communication has happened for millennia, it was still much more limited because of travel restrictions, expense, as well as limited technology to travel around the world. But because of the internet, that changed drastically in the late 1990s. So in the 1980s and into the 1990s, the angst and possibility of new futures with the end of the Cold War, new international wars, as well as a greater consciousness of global events through this communication technology, begat a decade of peacetime on the continent of North America with a narrative focused on personal psychology and fulfillment that was explicitly conscious of the past social norms of the last 3 to 4 decades, as well as a security from war considered, at least in North America, and a focus on rapidly expanding economics with a strong counter narrative against the greed and personal excess that the 80s and 90s also produced in elaboration and collaboration with the focus on personal well-being because of the economic boom that happened in North America. So this is all what was happening in terms of my consciousness of what is going on in the world. Personal health, especially due to the HIV/AIDS epidemic and the drug epidemic, also focused people inward and created a sense of fear, but was a focus on personal choices because a lot of the choices that people talked about were in regards to protecting oneself from certain things that were happening in society and around the world. Then in 2000, the election of George W. Bush became, because of a Supreme Court decision and 9/11, with the recognition that we were all vulnerable to large-scale attacks, shifted the world of North America into a two decades long hyperactive existential and emotional crisis. Greater awareness of not only one's personal vulnerability, but also a greater awareness that we all were interconnected in ways that people may not have realized before. So when we talk about becoming conscious of what is happening in society, we also need to start talking about new values and new norms and new ways of being that were being understood based on this past consciousness of history, but also in the recognition that we were in a state of transition and not knowing. So in the past, definitions of good were more or less created through narratives of social pressure. So like I said, in the 40s and 50s, it was settle down, create a nice life, enjoy the goods of the earth and the goods of technology. In the 60s and 70s, it was more, let's question what those goods were and create new goods, such as new relationships, creating a new definition of what love means, focusing more on emotions in some ways than the more mechanistic vision of what was good in the earlier decades. In the 80s and 90s, there was a little bit of a combination of those two tensions where greed and excess in terms of sensual pleasures, as well as things like drugs and the excesses of society creating more oppression on people, started to create deeper tensions, but also deeper opportunities for what was good. So it was about finding self-fulfillment. It was about creating ways of living that were new, but also prosperous. And so that was considered good. So there's still this material and emotional facet, and spirituality and religion were also there as kind of a third rung of what was good. And because of immigration waves of different kinds, there were a variety of different narratives, even though the dominant narrative was primarily Protestant within Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism, Hinduism, and Eastern religions as kind of a smaller sect that has grown exponentially in the United States in terms of narrative that didn't exist in the same way in the 40s and 50s, 60s and 70s. 60s and 70s started to bring in Eastern religions such as Taoism, Buddhism, and Hinduism. So all of that being said, we've constantly asked ourselves, what is good? And different people have had different definitions of what is good throughout the different decades. And the question then becomes, well, okay, what do people need to live a good life? And that is the question that is the reason that I started asking that question, because it's clear that we still do not know. And as a society, we're still trying to answer that question as we adapt to new realities. So a lot of us might feel like we know some things that make a good life, but as a society, we also need to think about how other people conceptualize good differently, and how do we live in a true democracy with true diversity of different conceptualizations of good. And that's why identity comes into this, because people from different identities will understand good differently. Somebody with a religious identity of Protestant will have a different understanding of what is good than somebody who's got a religious identity as Jewish, for example. There will be plenty of overlap, but there will also be some really important distinctions. And so how do we live together in this way? Those are some of the deep issues that I think we are confronting now with this greater communication. And unfortunately, we've been fractured more than we've come together with greater understanding and misunderstanding about what it means to orient oneself to a different kind of good than somebody else. I've also come to recognize through study and experience, even, and I can't say I come to recognize, this has been something that has been a major facet of my life since I was old enough to have friends who did not have the same material goods that I did, that there are some very serious inequities and social justice issues within all society. And when we talk about good from a societal perspective, as well as from an individual perspective, we need to talk about things like power, we need to talk about things like material reality, and we need to talk about things like justice. And so this question to me is a deeply ethical and moral question oriented towards social justice, because if there are people whose identities have been marginalized and oppressed, what does social justice look like? Because if there is no justice, there will be no ability to create a world where people can get what they need to live a good life. So we need a lot of different things, and it comes from various levels of global issues to, we can call it country level issues, to community level issues, to individual issues, where there are different people who have a variety of different experiences. And how do we bring that all together so that everybody can actually live a good life where the things that they see it are good, as long as they're not hurting somebody else or oppressing somebody else, are able to be enacted in the world? And that's really where I think this question gets to. And the implications of this question, why I study learning and identity, is that all of the things that happen within the society that we deal with have learning and identity at the core. Because if we learn that there are people who deserve goods and there are people who don't deserve goods, that is something that we learn. That is not something that we're born with. We are born with a sense of, in some sense, what is fair and not fair. But how do we enact that fairness, and how do we learn what it means for some people to get something and other people to not get something, is a really deep and important question. And that's where I think we need to start to focus much more heavily in terms of our own research and our own thinking. So those are a few of the reasons why I started to get into this question and why I think it's so important.
Lastly, your favorite book.
Before I go into what my favorite books are, I wanted to clarify one thing about what I said earlier. When we talk about identities and learning who gets what, it's also important to think about learning how to treat people and how to honor people as human beings, but also honoring their identities. So we can talk about goods, which is one facet of it. But when we talk about problems and issues in society right now, we are dealing with a major issue of how we treat others. And I think that learning and identity research can really contribute to some of those questions. Why is it that there are folks who treat people from certain identities in ways that are discriminatory or biased or bigoted? How is it that there are other people who are able to get along with people from a variety of different identities and understand what it means to live in a harmonious way where everybody's identities can be respected, honored, engaged with in a way that is, you know, productive and caring and kind? So these facets of identity and learning are fundamental in my mind to some of the issues going on with society. So I just wanted to clarify that, because it's not just about goods, but it's about how we treat each other, how we relate to each other, what it means to be a human being living in a society that's full of different kinds of relationships with the earth, with each other, with the variety of things going on. So that's just one part of clarification. Now, onto books. I think that I can pick three books off the top of my head that are really important to this kind of work. One is Teaching to Transgress by Bell Hooks. Although it doesn't necessarily speak to identity specifically, it does speak to the ways in which identities interact with teaching and learning. And I think it's a really useful way of thinking through the ways in which identity intersects with learning and intersects with pedagogy. The second book is The Principles of Psychology by William James, because he talks about self and the development of self and how we learn to become a self. And I think that's a foundational text for that kind of work. The third one is Sources of the Self, The Making of the Modern Identity, which is by Charles Taylor. So that one is really great historical overview about how we conceptualize identity and how identity has changed over the years to mean different things, from how it was conceptualized with the pre-Socratics all the way on to the postmodern society.
Thank you, Joe. It has been great to have you.
It's been great. It's nice talking with you. And if you have any further questions, you can email me or reach out to us at the Action Research Podcast.